I think the fact that we don't have vaccine manufacturing capability that can go to scale is a huge problem both for our country and for Africa, and a huge missed opportunity for revenue, for development, and for R&D and innovation in that sector.
From fighting HIV/AIDS denialism in the 90s to leading the battle against COVID-19, Professor Glenda Gray, first female head of the South African Medical Research Council, is no stranger to speaking truth to power. I'm Julia Taylor, the National Medical Head of Investec Private Bank, and I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Investec Focus Talks, a series of candid conversations with leaders, innovators, and changemakers. In this Focus Talk podcast, I'm privileged to be joined by Professor Glenda Gray, the co-lead investigator of the South African Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine trial, a world-leading perinatal HIV researcher, and a woman on a mission to ensure universal access to healthcare. Welcome, Prof, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and good morning.
This week marks the first anniversary of South Africa's initial lockdown. Described as one of the strictest in the world, what are your reflections looking back on the past year, our response to the pandemic, and some of your highs and lows?
So I think this year has been an incredibly difficult year at a global level. And so we weren't sure what was going to happen at a global level or at a local level. And when we went into lockdown, I think we had this belief that we would be able to control the virus, stop the transmission, and get back to our normal life, which I think was probably, on retrospect, pretty naive. I do think that the initial lockdown went on for too long and was too harsh. I don't think the country was ready to deliver the social services that was required to keep vulnerable people at home and to support the people that needed food and relief of poverty relief. There have been other ramifications of the lockdown, and I think it's a combination of the whole idea was to preserve lives and to try and balance lives and livelihoods. And so despite the lockdowns, we've had a very harsh epidemic. Lots of South Africans, as we speak, over 1.5 million people in South Africa have had COVID. The official deaths are around 53,000, and our excess deaths in this whole period is north of 143,000. And so we've had a lot of mortality, a lot of morbidity. We've had our health system stretched to the limit, on the verge of running out of oxygen, and healthcare workers completely burnt out with inadequate PPE protection. When you look back, I'm not too sure whether we can really judge whether we did anything right or wrong. I think we have to accept that we did the best that we could with the available evidence. And maybe the only reflection is from our part is that one needs to move in and out of lockdown periods much more faster and more nimbly than we have done. And so you don't have to wait for 2 weeks before you see when you have an inkling that the infections are coming down, is to rather move faster into opening up the economy and to try and preserve jobs at the same time.
And that makes sense. And I mean, on that point you raise around the lockdowns and, you know, moving into them quicker and out of them quicker, there is talk of a third wave. There is talk of a stricter level of lockdown over Easter. Do you think that's likely? Do you think we're likely to go into another level of lockdown or a stricter level of lockdown now? And is the third wave inevitable?
I think the third wave is inevitable. As we go into winter months, people start to crowd inside houses. There's less ventilation. People start to do things indoors. And whenever you're in poorly ventilated places where there are lots of crowds, then you're more likely to increase transmission. And so I do think we expect to see a third wave in winter. If we look at Europe, they went through a third wave in their winter months. And so we had a very harsh second wave. And I think everyone is bracing themselves for a third wave that may be as harsh as our second wave. So in terms of the lockdown and what we should be doing over Easter, obviously Easter or any holiday period represents a high risk period for transmission. And curtailing movement or implementing curfew or restricting crowds is a good way to try and mitigate transmission that may occur at this period of time.
And in terms of our healthcare system, you spoke of, obviously, in your previous comments around, a healthcare sector being ready for the initial COVID-19 pandemic when it started, and some of the lack of PPE, et cetera. What's our position now? Should we go into a third wave? Are we a little bit more prepared?
Well, I think we've been trying to rush to vaccinate healthcare workers before the end of April in a way to try and protect them before the third wave. And so hopefully by the end of April, there will be the official rollout of the vaccine program and we can get more healthcare workers vaccinated. We've tried to get healthcare workers who are patient-facing, who are in the front line of COVID infections and who have to manage people who have got COVID. So we've tried to get to those healthcare workers to protect them before the next wave. And hopefully the rest of the healthcare workers can follow suit. In terms of PPE, I think that the country has got smarter and the quality of PPE has improved as well as the quality and quantity. In terms of oxygen, hopefully we've learned from the second wave and our oxygen supplies will keep us going. And in terms of our health systems, hopefully we've become used to working in a COVID surge and that we can try and keep both non-COVID and both COVID health programs working. In the first wave and in the first part of the lockdown, people were too scared to go to hospital and we stopped diagnosing TB, we stopped managing HIV properly, and women who were pregnant were too scared to go for antenatal care. We also know that immunization rates in South Africa went down because our parents also didn't want to take their children to be immunized. And so there was a lot of ramifications of the lockdown on other non-COVID related medical events, such as TB, HIV and antenatal care. And we had to try and keep the health system open so that we can attend to all the other ailments in our country, but at the same time be ready and nimble to support the managing COVID infections in the hospital.
Yeah, it's a balancing act, I'm sure. You speak about the vaccines and the vaccines for the South African healthcare workers. You and your team were instrumental in securing the initial doses of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for South Africa. And so far in its initial vaccination phase, South Africa's vaccinated just over 1 in 10 of the 1.2 million frontline healthcare workers. And I know we're targeting around 16 million people in the second stage due to begin in April. In your opinion, are we on track? Will we have enough vaccines? How will we get them to the far-flung corners of South Africa? And do you feel there's a clear plan for the vaccine rollout?
Well, I think I'll start off with the Sasonke study that we're doing, which we give 500,000 healthcare workers the vaccine. So demand is always outstrip supply, and that's always been the problem both in South Africa and at a global level. If you have a look at what's going on everywhere in the world, people are desperate for vaccination. And we see the same thing in South Africa. So we only have 500,000 vaccines at the moment, and we see a huge demand. The vaccines are coming in small amounts, and so before the next batch comes in, they've been sapped up by the health system. So this gives us an indication that there is huge demand, which is a good thing because you don't want vaccine hesitancy. Yeah. So the important thing is that the demand is good. And now, now as we move into the vaccine rollout, we have to make sure that the supply happens and that we don't run out of vaccines in any part of the program. And at this moment in time, at a global level, in the next 2 or 3 months, there are global shortages of vaccine. We've already seen the EU trying to impose restrictions on the movement of vaccines out of the European Union. We also saw that in India with the Serum Institute. There were talks of nationalizing the vaccine in India, and obviously, common sense prevailed, and hopefully common sense will prevail in Europe to make sure that vaccines can flow to areas of the world where we need it. South Africa is the country in Africa that has been the most affected by the COVID epidemic. And so we should emphasize access to parts of Africa that have had the greatest burden. And so obviously South Africa should be a beneficiary of access, and access much quicker than other countries that have not had such a bad epidemic. And so I think what we're going to be seeing is that in the next 3 or 4 months, there is going to be a global dash for vaccines. And as soon as manufacturing ramps up and as soon as supplies start to come on board, we can find ourselves in a much better steady state, and supplies will be continuous, and there won't be such a mad dash, hopefully, for vaccines. I do believe that South Africa is well equipped to roll out the vaccine. Just my limited experience with this 500,000 program, you know, we've seen a health system that can rise to the occasion, and also obviously the public and private sector are critical for doing these vaccine programs. What we have to do when we roll out the vaccine is to be innovative. If we have a look at some of the innovations from overseas, big stadia, church halls, schools, and having mass vaccination events will be the way to really make sure we can get to all parts of the country. And I would recommend that in rural places and more remote places, you do have mass vaccination events where in one village or in one town, you set up a program which allows people to commute into the center to be vaccinated. In areas where people are poor and can't get to these centers, obviously you're going to have a mobile vaccine unit. And already we're looking at these mobile units that can house a fridge, a nurse, a driver, and can basically go from village to village to vaccinate people in a way that allows access. So we're going to have to think outside the box. We're going to have to use a lot of innovation that's non-medical in terms of logistics, and we're going to have to make sure that the medical system is well equipped to be adaptable. Already we're seeing a global shortage of syringes and needles, and so we have to make sure that in our country that we also have enough supply. It would be terrible to have all the vials, all the vaccines in the country and no syringes and needles. And so already we've seen the prices of needles and syringes going up, and a dash at a global level for syringes. And so those are the kind of things that are going to maybe hamper our rollout. I do believe that the private sector has a role to play, and also logistics and the management of supply chain management, stock management, and also quality assurance. We have to make sure that we're drawing up the right amount of vaccine, the right dose, and we're administering it in the correct way. And so all of that also requires a lot of oversight, which is very possible in our country.
Okay, and speak about obviously the private sector and the role the private sector can play in partnership with the public sector, and around specifically you named around sort of logistical and distribution elements of it. What about procurement?
I think the procurement issue is always going to be a tricky issue. There's an indemnification that countries have to give, a no-fault compensation for the vaccines, because obviously these are new vaccines and we don't know what the long-term side effects are. And so in terms of procurement, I guess who's ever willing to support the indemnification and the funds to support something like that should be taken into consideration. So there are kind of a couple of barriers for individual or private procurement. One is the indemnification. Two is the kind of volumes that one needs to purchase to be taken seriously. And three is the issue of quality. We have to make sure that the vaccines that are coming into our country are not contraband, are not counterfeit. And we have to make sure that they are SAHPRA approved, and that there's data and information that these vaccines work in our country with our variant. And so I do think that collective bargaining, that the public and private sector should be going to the manufacturers together with their money and saying, okay, here's our money, and you know how much vaccine can give us, and work in a way that harmonizes the distribution. We also want to ensure equity. We don't want to be in a situation where we procure vaccines in the private sector at the peril of people who also need it, who are poor and who also have comorbidities and who are also vulnerable to COVID. And so whatever mechanism we use, there has to be equity built in. We have to be able to access rural areas of the country, and we have to make sure that these vaccines are good quality vaccines and that they work in our country. We don't want vaccines that don't work in the country, and we want to make sure that we don't get vaccines that are counterfeit.
When do you think that we'll see South Africa's own vaccine production capability ramp up? I mean, you speak about global shortage and obviously us bringing the vaccines into South Africa and the 500,000 that we secured from Johnson & Johnson. I mean, Aspen is going to be producing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. We've also seen that BioVac has announced a local manufacturing partnership with the US-based immune therapy firm Immunity Bio to offer the vaccine in the form of an oral tablet. What are your thoughts on these developments and the impact it can have in South Africa?
I think they're critical. I think the fact that we don't have vaccine manufacturing capability that can go to scale is a huge problem both for our country and for Africa, and a huge missed opportunity for revenue, for development, and for R&D and innovation in that sector. You know, we should have a serum institute that like India has, and we should aspire to that. So I do believe Aspen's going to be doing the fill and finish. They're already busy with their quality assurance, and very soon millions of vials of vaccine are going to roll off their production line, and hopefully some of them will be also for local use and not all to be exported elsewhere. And I think that's an important thing. The BioVac is very important. It's a public-private partnership, BioVac. We need state investment in manufacturing, and we need the state to see the importance of investing in R&D, particularly in the medical sector. We do need to become self-sufficient. We do need to be global players in vaccine manufacturing. And it's a wonderful opportunity for South Africa, and hopefully we'll seize this opportunity now that we have seen how we are hampered by the lack of ability to manufacture our own vaccines.
Yeah. I think it would be worth taking a step back and just focusing a little bit more on yourself, Prof. I mean, you've shown determination to defeat at least one, if not both, the COVID-19 and the HIV pandemics in South Africa. Tell us more about your work in HIV and specifically any lessons that you've learned through your many years in this space that you could apply to the current crisis.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been involved in the HIV epidemic for many years. In fact, when COVID started, I kind of said to my colleagues, I'm going to sit this epidemic out. I'm going to write scientific articles and just, like, you know, stay at home and learn to garden. However, our life changes, and very soon I found myself in the middle of it. And I think the first part of it was the need for a research strategy. So when the first case of COVID broke out, the DG from the Department of Science and Innovation phoned me and said, okay, what is our strategy? What's our research strategy? And I was boarding a plane from Durban to Cape Town and opened up my laptop and kind of thought, okay, what is our strategy for COVID? And the first thing was the testing. You know, at a global level, there was a mass shortage of tests that were available. We were going into lockdown. You know, our airports were closed. You know, we were hampered by that. So it was very important to invest very early on in testing. Second thing is that we had no idea what the natural history of COVID would be in our country. And so to set up systems to do that. And so you learn from HIV in that same way. In the beginning with HIV, we had issues with testing. You know, we went from ELISA-based testing in the laboratory with a two-week turnaround to a point-of-care diagnosis in a rural village. And, you know, that was innovation. Almost now to you can do your self-testing and saliva testing. So there's huge innovation in testing, and we were able to apply that. Also, with our experience in TB, we used Gene Expert, and that whole infrastructure allowed us to quickly adapt to COVID testing. And a lot of the lessons learned in TB we could rapidly apply to COVID, and eventually the National Health Laboratory Service was able to really ramp up and is obviously one of the biggest testers in Africa. So that was important. Obviously, my experience with vaccines. So I've been, I failed very often with an HIV vaccine. So I've been involved in HIV vaccine work in South Africa. And we, at this moment in time, we're working on an AD26 HIV vaccine, actually with J&J. And the same platform was used for Ebola, for Zika, and then was adapted for the SARS-CoV-2. And so given my experience with the AD26 HIV vaccine, I was in a wonderful position to be part of the leadership team to evaluate the SARS-CoV-2 AD26 vaccine, which was in a trial called Ensemble 1. And, you know, we were able to lobby to have South Africa be part of the global trial. And we were able to lobby for myself to be part of the leadership, which was great because basically that put us in the right position. We got quick experience with the vector, the vaccine, and we also were able to then rapidly translate. And so obviously HIV has gifted this epidemic in many ways. One is in vaccine design. Two is the clinical trial infrastructure in South Africa that was able to be deployed. So we just basically moved from doing HIV vaccines to doing SARS-CoV-2 vaccines, and which was great. So we had staff who knew how we had cold chain storage, backup generators, pharmacists, doctors and nurses who could, rapidly move to roll out a COVID vaccine trial. So we were very fortunate in HIV gifted the country that. And then obviously the laboratories that we have in this country that were able to go from looking at neutralizing HIV and to neutralizing COVID and understanding some of the issues around the immunology of COVID. Our experience with whole genome sequencing enabled us quickly also rapidly to move from HIV to be able to sequence the SARS-CoV-2 and to pick up the variant that was starting to evolve in mid-October. And so the HIV, as an HIV researcher, the experience that I've gained and that we've gained from regulatory oversight to ethical oversight and to the conduct of trials has helped us a lot. And so I was quite fortunate to have kind of been in HIV research for all these years and rapidly employed. I made a joke about this. Obviously, it's been my lifelong goal to find an HIV vaccine. And it's ironical that I failed so often at an HIV vaccine, and then the first COVID vaccine trial I'm involved in works. So it's quite nice to have success after so many years of failure. It's a lovely experience to work with a vaccine that works.
And that all that work wasn't for nothing. I mean, at the end of the day, you've produced results now, and I'm sure the good work in terms of the HIV vaccine will continue. Is there anything that's come out of the work you've done with HIV and the vaccines that sort of helped you deal with vaccine hesitancy around COVID-19 vaccine in South Africa?
Well, I think, it's interesting, we never saw any vaccine hesitancy in HIV, and maybe people who volunteered to be in an HIV vaccine trial understood their vulnerability, and also because they had been severely affected, their families had been severely affected by HIV, wanted to do something for the future. And a lot of people who volunteer for HIV vaccine trials say they're doing it to help the future. They're doing it because their sister died and they want to contribute to science, and they feel a huge calling, to contribute. So we never really saw that. Such hesitancy. And I think I was really happy to see the demand for COVID vaccines amongst healthcare workers. And maybe they're the easiest, they're the low-hanging fruit, in fact, because they understand vaccines. They're in the front line. They're 47 times more likely to get COVID. And so they know that they need a vaccine. And there's a lot of old people and people with comorbidities that also are feeling incredibly vulnerable. And there's so many people that have lost loved ones, friends, colleagues from COVID, that it's hard to understand why anyone would be hesitant to take a vaccine that has been shown to reduce death and hospitalization and to get a little bit of your life back by taking a vaccine.
Prof, taking another step back again about you. I mean, you've got a reputation as an activist, a fearless advocate for doing what's right. Looking at your work over the past years, you've always been driven by a clear agenda of getting universal healthcare to everyone that needs it. Where does this fierce conviction come from? And what inspired you from such a young age to challenge the status quo and start the work that you did?
Well, I think, I grew up in a big family, a family of six. We weren't rich. And I guess I always felt human compassion and empathy for people who were less fortunate and suffered more than ourselves. But I think the true advocacy came in two parts. One was being a pediatrician and starting your career when there was no HIV. And then as you qualify, every third child in your ward is HIV infected and dying, and young mothers are also dying. and having to see women give birth and then find out that they're HIV positive and watch their baby die is a devastating thing. And we were very lucky, I guess, at that stage because I was working with an obstetrician and we were following up mothers who were infected and their babies. And at that stage, a trial called ACTG-076 found that AZT could prevent mother-to-child transmission. And so we became involved in these programs. And then I guess when the government didn't want to roll out these programs, this enraged me and a whole lot of other activists. And, you know, and hence that work in advocacy with mother-to-child transmission. But it came before that because, you know, obviously at medical school and as a young doctor, I worked in progressive health organizations, the Health Workers Association, and which became the South African Health Workers Congress. And in those entities, you know, you learned about universal health coverage. You learned about the importance of equality and the unfairness of a segregated, apartheid-style hospital system. And so, you know, so I was very lucky because I was exposed early on as a young doctor to progressive ideas, to the UDF and to programs that address the issues around equality and segregation in healthcare. And that was a good foundation for the work that I did in mother-to-child transmission and ensure that we had rollout. I also learned very early on how important science is and how important evidence is, because we had evidence. When you have evidence, you know, you can go to the courts because you can prove that there's an intervention that works. So I quickly realized how critical science is for advocacy and how critical science is for activism, because you have to have data, you have to have evidence, and only evidence and data changes policy, and only evidence and data impacts on life. And so understanding that link and how important science is for changing people's lives is a very powerful tool. So I was very lucky to learn that very early on, you know, that knowledge is power, and, you know, power and knowledge is king, and you use that knowledge to better the world. And we use that knowledge for fighting to get the government to prevent, to give mother-to-child transmission prevention. And that was all because of science, and that we had the evidence to do that.
What I have noticed is that you represent this robust scientific community that isn't afraid to express themselves. And I think, you know, the point you raised now around having the facts and the hard data, which means that some of those conversations are a little bit easier to have because they're based on science, which really then obviously helps. On the point around equality and inclusion versus exclusion, the COVID-19 mantra is that the virus will not be contained anywhere in the world unless it's suppressed everywhere. But it seems we're heading towards sort of a two-tiered world where pariah states that have unvaccinated populations are potentially locked off and rich countries close borders. This could obviously massively amplify global inequality. Is this a likely scenario, Prof, or will longer-term thinking prevail?
I think in the short term, it's a likely scenario. So really in the short term, there's restriction on our movement because of the variant that has emerged in South Africa. You know, so already there's that restriction. And also because of the lack of global supply of vaccines will immediately mean that poor countries have less vaccine than rich countries, which then will also curtail their movement. And so until we improve the global supply, there will always be this two-tiered system in the world. And so it is true. I do believe that the quicker that at a global level we have vaccine, the better it's going to be for the poor countries, because we have to be involved in global trade. We have to be able to move. And so any restrictions on travel or on trade is going to impact terribly on poor countries, particularly South Africa. And so we've been devastated economically by this pandemic, and we can't have anything that exacerbates it further. And so it's very important that we address the global demands for a vaccine, and hopefully in the midterm, you know, we will be in a situation where we will have been able to vaccinate most of our population.
Prof, just two closing questions from my side. The first is around your personal experience on the front line of the pandemic. Tell us about that experience, and do you have a message for your fellow healthcare workers as they soldier on into 2021?
Our healthcare workers are the most courageous, hardworking, and selfless human beings. And they went out and they put on their PPE and their masks, and they took care of sick people. And they did it because that is what they were trained to do. And so they are incredibly courageous. Around 40,000 healthcare workers have been infected. You know, just under 7,000 have been hospitalized, and just over 650 have died taking care of people who were COVID infected. For them also, it's been a terrible time because they've had to manage death and dying and illness in a time where families can't see their loved ones, and you're in protective gear, which means that already there's a distance between you and your patient. You're also in a situation where oxygen runs, our supplies are run down, and you have to choose between this patient and the next. And sometimes you have to take care of patients in parking lots in the rain. And so they've been incredibly courageous. And, you know, I think we need to really acknowledge our foot soldiers who've gone out there in line of duty and done their job. I think that's an important thing. For scientists like me, my job, is to try and find solutions so that we can protect those foot soldiers. And so my job was to find a vaccine. I had the wonderful privilege of not only being involved in a vaccine trial at work, but the privilege of actually translating that vaccine trial into practice and being able to roll out a program that got to 500,000 healthcare workers. You know, there are days that you don't know how you're going to get through the day. I'm just knowing that yesterday, for instance, we vaccinated 12,000 healthcare workers. We were looking at some of the data yesterday, and we saw the rates of COVID infections going down in healthcare workers. And you start to think, Jesus, you know, this is living proof that a vaccine is working. And just to see those numbers, you know, makes you almost want to cry with gladness. And so for me, that's the part that's been really enjoyable, is being involved in an intervention that can transform the lives of healthcare workers. Obviously, there are also other issues as with every pandemic. There's always going to be political pressures and political issues, and the balance between political leadership and what scientists say. And there's always going to be a tension to that. And scientists obviously are vocal. They believe in, you know, freedom of expression, and always want their opinions to be heard. And that's always going to be sometimes in conflict with in a pandemic, you know, when there's a Disaster Management Act and you need to have, you know, a strong sense of command and control. And sometimes the last thing you want are outspoken scientists who are blabbing on the side. And so you have to find that balance. And I think for politicians, they have to find a way of listening and understanding, and for scientists, we have to find a way of advocating that doesn't cause hostility. And so I think we're all learning, we're all work in progress. And yeah, I think, you know, we have to learn how to value each other and how to work together for the better of the country.
Thank you. Those are very wise words, Prof. And thank you for your service. I think that no doubt you've done a lot. Sleepless nights, working for weeks and weeks on end without sleep, convincing warehouses to stay open all night. I do appreciate it, and I'm sure South Africa would echo my sentiments.
Well, thanks. I'm happy. I'm lucky to be part of a dedicated team. And, I'm fortunate that there's a lot of gifted, talented, and hardworking people that work with me, a team that's completely dedicated to supporting a vaccine rollout in the country.
And last question, Prof, and this one talks to you a little bit going forward and looking back. I mean, if we could go forward a couple of years and we were looking back on where we are now, where do you see South Africa and the world with regards to controlling the virus 5 years into the future? And what lessons do you hope that we would have all learned from what we've all gone through at this point?
So looking back, I hope that our country would understand the importance of surveillance, pandemic surveillance, pandemic readiness, and to make sure that we have systems in place to rapidly deploy diagnostics and to optimize surveillance, and so that we become very good at developing the kind of intelligence that you need to pick up an emerging pathogen and deal with it. So I think that's important, making sure that our health laboratories and our systems are in place to rise to any occasion. The second thing is never to be in a situation where you don't have a manufacturing capability in your country. And then hopefully if we've learned anything in the last, this last pandemic, is that we do need to invest in research and development. We do need to invest in manufacturing. We do need a vibrant pharmaceutical manufacturing program in the country. And we also need a vibrant scientific endeavor. And so what we are very lucky in Africa is that we have the most amazing world-class scientists. And making sure that these people are well funded with public funds, and making sure that they're able to respond like they have done, in the current pandemic, that they're the ones that identified the variant and they used public money to do that. And so what I also hope that at a country level, Treasury, the Department of Science and Innovation and the Department of Health realize the importance of putting, public money into research. And we saw that in the US with Operation Warp Speed, how the importance of federal funds and the role it plays to secure vaccines in the future. So because of the investments that the US government put into vaccines, they have hundreds of millions of vaccines available. And that's because it was the public purse. And so we have to understand that to be able to do this kind of thing, we need to make sure that the public purse continues to fund research and not see science or research as a luxury, but a necessity to improve access to health and wealth.
Thank you, Prof. Appreciate the words and appreciate your time today. I know firsthand you are an extremely busy lady, so thank you. We really do appreciate you being with us today to answer some of these questions and to impart some of your advice and knowledge. Thank you for listening to this Investec Focus Talk podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, please take a moment to rate us. And to listen to more of our candid conversations with leaders, innovators, and change makers, make sure you subscribe to Investec Focus Radio wherever you get your podcasts.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendation. Investec Specialist Bank, a division of Investec Bank Limited, is a registered credit provider.